The dogma was necessary. Without it, the people who have built this ecosystem into what it is today wouldn't have had the motivation to do so. Without that dogma, those people would not have had customers and users to build anything for in the first place. It was the foundation of everything we have around us today. Now, the inevitable is happening. The foundation is cracking. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Do not forget to check out our YouTube channel and all of the content we have over there. Just because I've had actually two or three people ask me about the Devs Who Can't Code series, and that is actually only on YouTube and Rumble. Actually, those might not have updated on Rumble because my mirroring of the YouTube upload, I think, broke. So I will fix that if it's not on Rumble, but both of those platforms, because it's video only, it's actually not available anywhere else, at least not yet. I'm still working on that. But don't forget that we actually have a lot of content and stuff, really fun stuff over there, I think, that is not, you're not going to find in the podcast feed. And obviously, don't forget to check out AI Unchained as well, which is what that is a sub-show of, The Devs Who Can't Code. And if you haven't checked out AI Unchained, what are you doing? You're missing out. It's a fantastic show. We have a lot of fun. Also, this is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the best place to buy Bitcoin and get yourself on a Bitcoin standard. Get all the tools and all the financial services you need. And then CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet. People have been showing me their Cold Card queues because all the shipments are going out. And I'm still real jelly. Mine's not in yet. Unless I send it to the other address. I'll have to go check. Maybe actually I'll be getting it very, very soon. I'm curious. But it looks really cool, and we will be talking about it on the show as soon as mine comes in. Get yourself a hardware wallet. Secure your coins. It's a no-brainer. Actually, it is a necessity for being in Bitcoin the smart way. Now, today, we have an article. Just want to say also thank you, and it was fantastic to meet and see everybody at Bitblock Boom. I had a wonderful freaking time, and I was, again, I think I've mentioned this before, but I was really close to not being able to go, and I am so happy that that did not happen, and I was able to go because we had an absolute blast. Michael, Matliff, BTK, I mean, I've hung out with BTK a number of times before, but I hadn't met Michael before, Johnny and Yida, and a good number of people, actually. It was legit wonderful seeing everybody and meeting all you guys. If you're in Nashville, hit me up. If you go to Lugano, it'll be good to hang out again. But it was just awesome getting to see a bunch of Audionauts in person. So thank you guys. I had a blast. Today, we have an article by Shinobi. And this is from Bitcoin Magazine, and this is their inscription issue, which I haven't really dug into, and I'm curious the arguments they have for and against the whole inscriptions issue, the inscriptions and stamps situation. But I haven't really dug into it much yet. Shinobi, however, has a very interesting article that's, I kind of think of as more of a big picture view, like step back and what's happening in the social sphere and what's happening when we think about it from the context of beliefs and ideology and what is kind of being honed and built around this and what might be the consequences of it and what might this have arisen from. And he's got a really fascinating analogy to the Catholic Church and the history of, you know, certain sects and schisms within other religious belief systems. And I think it's a really apt analogy, and there's some really interesting kind of threads that he pulls on in this one. So I will save it all for the guy's take, and we will just go ahead and get right into today's article. Again, it is by Shinobi, and it is titled Dogma Kills Brain Cells by Shinobi. All cultures require some overarching belief to hold it together as a cohesive identity. But when that belief is followed too blindly, it leads to stagnation and dissent. From the inscription issue. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the cringiest of them all? Is it the JPEG people, or is it the laser-eyed maxis, or is it both? The Bitcoin ecosystem has always had a dogmatic streak. It's kind of an inherent part of it. It takes a certain degree of stubbornness or dogma to get involved in something like Bitcoin this early on, and demonstrate the type of conviction necessary to hold along for the ride. Bitcoin is almost 15 years old, and a lot of the newer people who just entered the space in the last few years don't really understand how wildly different the entire landscape was even just 5 years ago. You used to be able to feed a $50 bill into a Bitcoin ATM and get 0.25 Bitcoin for it with nothing but a phone number and no filters or restrictions on burner numbers with no KYC attached. There were no nation states adopting Bitcoin as legal tender. The only ETF attempts were 100% guaranteed to be denied without a chance at serious consideration or approval. Lightning was still just a vague concept with nothing deployed in the real world. You had to be at least a little bit dogmatic to even consider for a moment putting any sizable amount of your net worth into Bitcoin. There was no real indication of its success at all, except belief in its design. If you didn't have that, you likely didn't stick around to the present day. At the very least, you walked in and out of the door frequently enough to wind up with much less than you could have had if you just stayed put. That dogma was necessary. Without it, the people who have built this ecosystem into what it is today wouldn't have had the motivation to do so. Without that dogma, those people would not have had customers and users to build anything for in the first place. It was the foundation of everything we have around us today. Now, the inevitable is happening. The foundation is cracking. What church do you go to? The thing with dogma is that the vast majority of the time it starts to fracture, the growth of discontent and dissent within the existing dogma, it doesn't die. It multiplies. And that outgrowth externally tends to reinforce the existing dogma within those who remain. When people in Europe started to ideologically diverge from the Catholic Church, they didn't destroy it. They fractured off and created their own church with their own conflicting dogma. There was no death and decay of the Catholic Church as it faded off into irrelevance. Instead, the Protestant Reformation led to a proliferation of numerous conflicting ideologies with their own dogma existing alongside the Catholic Church. The Protestant Reformation in the 1500s is always portrayed as being the first major dissent from the Catholic Church, painting life prior to Martin Luther as a peaceful environment of subservience to the Church. But this is not the historical reality. The Great Schism that led to the split between the Catholic Church and what became the Eastern Orthodox Church occurred approximately 500 years before Martin Luther's famous theses. What was the first domino to fall in the chain reaction that led to the schism? Churches in southern Italy that conducted Mass in Greek were informed by the Pope that they must start conducting their Masses in Latin. From here, disagreements multiplied. Was it acceptable to use unleavened bread in the sacrament of communion? The West thought it was. The East disagreed. Should priests have to remain celibate? The West thought they should. And again, the East disagreed. This ultimately culminated in a papal envoy being sent to Constantinople, where the head clergyman of the East, the ecumenical patriarch, had been directly voicing these disagreements to the Pope. During the meetings in Constantinople, disagreements boiled up to the point of the head of the envoy excommunicating the patriarch, and the patriarch excommunicating the members of the envoy. This fracture never healed, and led to the permanent schism between the Catholic Church and what became the Eastern Orthodox Church. That schism is not unlike the divide between small blockers and large blockers that culminated in a split of sorts in the 2017 end of the block size wars. Both Catholics and the divergent Eastern believers worshipped God. They both agreed on the holy divinity of Jesus Christ. There was no disagreement or rifts on core fundamental truths such as that, just like ultimately small blockers and big blockers alike, both wanted Bitcoin to succeed and grow to become a dominant economic force in the world. They simply disagreed on how to go about accomplishing that. They had the exact same goal, but differences in thoughts on how to achieve it led to an irreconcilable division that has lasted 6 years, or over 1,000 years in the case of the churches. At least they took over the dominant dogma, right? Wrong. The estimated population of Catholics is 1 billion people today, versus some 200 million people belonging to the Eastern Orthodox Church. In both cases, despite creating a new dogma that gathered a significant number of devout believers, neither the Orthodox Church nor the big blockers actually destroyed or subsumed the previous existing dogma. Breaking news at 10. When you tell someone everything they believe about the universe around them is wrong, they dig deeper into their pre-existing beliefs. The Protestants' disgust with indulgences. So now that we have established that the Protestants were not the first to diverge from the Catholic Church, let's look at what actually happened to elicit such a harsh reaction from Martin Luther. Indulgences. The idea that you could just pay your way into having your sins forgiven. A common ascribed phrase to advertise indulgences, often cited as one of the things that finally pushed Luther over the edge, was, "As soon as the coin into the box rings, a soul from purgatory to heaven springs." That is how boldly Catholic priests would push the idea that by giving the church money, you would automatically be absolved of your sins. Just follow these simple, easy steps to find your guaranteed economic salvation. Sound familiar? Just dollar cost average, just read this book, just follow these simple steps and you are guaranteed to find your salvation. Just getting your hands on 0.1 Bitcoin ensures you a seat at the table as a member of the economic elite of the New World Order. Promises like this are completely delusional, and the parallels between that type of evangelization and the Catholic practice of indulgences are so stark, they're undeniable. In the framework of this analogy, I would say the JPEG people represent the Protestants. They are a group of Bitcoiners who are fed up with the notion that, quote, "This one simple trick is enough to guarantee an individual's financial success in using Bitcoin." They are especially fed up with so much energy in this space being devoted to catering to that attitude and narrative. I honestly can't blame them, and I agree with some of the things that they criticize and are upset with. It has not only become a dominant attitude in this space that no one needs to really do anything in order for Bitcoin to succeed, but many people with that attitude actively attack, fud and disrupt efforts or ideas to address shortcomings of Bitcoin that could lead to its failure. I have spoken up about this dynamic and the problems it is exacerbating many times over the years. It's not surprising to me in the slightest to see a new subculture and dogma rise in this space, defining itself through opposition to this blind attitude of preordained success. Here's a cold, hard reality check. Like I said earlier, the Protestant Reformation didn't eclipse and wipe out the Catholic Church. Even at an estimated population of 800 million to 1 billion people, roughly the same size as the Catholic population, Protestants have not marginalized the Catholic Church. The Pope is still one of the most listened to and respected religious figures around the world. Catholicism is still adhered to worldwide. And the funniest part? Shortly after Martin Luther's death, the church banned the exchange of money for the forgiving of one's sins. What does this teach us? Despite the primary reason for Protestants leaving and forming their own dogma actually being addressed and forbidden by the church, they didn't come back. Why is that? And another factor I just mentioned above is the Protestant population is almost 1 billion people. They are not at all a single congregation or dogma. The Protestants continued fracturing and dividing, forming a large set of conflicting and contradictory dogmas over the years. They did not remain or grow into a single competitive group competing with Catholicism. Dissent breeds dissent. Does it make more sense now why Catholicism was never actually usurped or subsumed by new dogmas? Nothing ever grew to the size that it actually could. The pre-existing dogma didn't just sit around content and unchanging. It evolved around dissent strong enough to actually incite material amounts of people to challenge and leave it. If some aspect of current dogma was so disliked and disagreed with that people became dissuaded from its accuracy, eventually the current dogma changed to acknowledge that. From a cold and logical point of view, it's simply a matter of survival. And what of the new dogmas that were birthed before that period of adaptation and evolution? They continued on and did not simply fold back into their original belief after it conceded to their disagreement. But that dissent, that acceptance of it, the fact that to a degree the new dogma was actually defined by it, festered. This encouraged people who adapted the new dogma to dissent even from that, and this cycle repeated itself. This is why there is no single, quote, Protestant dogma. You have the Lutherans and the Calvinites, the Anglicans, the Baptists, the Quakers, the Methodists, etc. The list goes on and on. We have seen the same thing with big blockers. First, the Bitcoin Cash people split from Bitcoin. Then Bitcoin Cash split into Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV. Both of them had numerous splits from that point among themselves. Why should anyone expect the JPEG people to be any different? They too predominantly define themselves as, quote, against the laser eyes. They cheer themselves as, quote, doing what the laser eyes couldn't, as they pat themselves on the back for spurring adoption. They too seem to base a large portion of their camaraderie around, quote, owning the laser eyes. Their entire dogma is almost entirely defined by its existence as an opposite to the dogma of the laser eyes. This is why, in all likelihood, there will be no long-lasting cultural effect to come of this new dogma as it exists today. There is nothing it can define itself by in a vacuum. Every Christian ostensibly stands on their faith in Jesus Christ, but many denominations define that faith by standing in contrast to the Catholic Church. What is that in terms of the foundation for a belief? What does that really define a person as in terms of goals, motivations, or net productive output? The JPEG people claim they are here to, quote, make Bitcoin fun again, to get people engaged and interested in using it. And there is undeniably a good number of people in that community who actually live by that. But there is, in my experience, a much larger number of people who define themselves through their actions as simply existing to, quote, own the laser eyes. That doesn't produce anything of value. That doesn't actually inspire people with a vision. Movements, dogmas, cultures, any of these things that are defined solely by their opposition to other movements or dogmas or cultures lose their identity the moment the thing they exist in opposition to is defeated. To really create a lasting and transformative cultural shift, there needs to be a foundation of identity that can exist on its own. So what is the identity of the JPEG people without laser eyes to troll? Is there even one there when you take that away? This article is featured in Bitcoin Magazine's The Inscription issue. This episode is brought to you by the Cold Card Q, which is finally shipping, and everybody has been showing it to me, and I've been super, super jealous. But the new Cold Card Q comes with a full QWERTY keyboard. It is like the Cypherpunk BlackBerry. It's got a QR code scanner and a new large screen. It includes all of the Mark IV, the Cold Card Mark IV features. Plus, it works on AAA batteries so that you don't have to worry about getting a manufacturer-specific battery or worry about smart battery vulnerabilities, God knows what. Simple, easy to power, they're available everywhere. It's got dual micro SD card slots and a dedicated NFC antenna so that it works really well. And of course, it can be used fully air-gapped throughout the entire process. USB and NFC data can be completely blocked. And in fact, because of the cypherpunks at CoinKite, they show you physically how you can just break the connection if you don't want any wireless ever active. You can literally break it at the electrical level, not firmware or software. This is the kind of paranoia that this device is built for. It is a bunker for your Bitcoin. And in the security hole-ridden world that is the internet, this is what you need to hold your own keys. This is how you know you are safe in Bitcoin land. So grab yourself a Cold Card Mark IV, which is the classic and is the one that I have, I think, three of. And of course, the Cold Card Q, the Cypherpunk BlackBerry with all of the additional features and full keyboard and everything that come with it. But no matter what you use, even if you're using the Tap Signer or Sats cards or Open Dimes or using any of the other products and hardware devices by CoinKite, there's a plethora of ways to secure and enjoy your Bitcoin at CoinKite.com. I'll have a link in the show notes to the video for the Cold Card Q, as well as my discount code BitcoinAudible, all one word, all caps, that you can use at the CoinKite store. Links and details all in the show notes. All right, so that was our article from Shinobi, again at Bitcoin Magazine, and I really liked this article. There's a couple of different things that I want to kind of use this as a jumping off point to discuss. Because having followed Shinobi for a long time and, read a bunch of his stuff and, followed him on social and seeing kind of where things have changed in this zone of time that he's talking about, and, just what it was like 5-7 years ago in Bitcoin, like night and day difference, the degree of, it's funny, like he says, you have to be dogmatic and basically some tiny amounts of insane to have been convicted that 5-6 years ago, Bitcoin had any real future. Because there was no, on the ground evidence of it, in the sense that it wasn't usable in any particular place, it wasn't widespread, it wasn't accepted by the establishment culture or even in the establishment mindset. You could still regularly mention the word Bitcoin to people and they would have no idea what you were talking about. And there were barely even any quote-unquote respectable companies operating in the Bitcoin space. It was largely just people, the crazy people in Bitcoin building services for Bitcoiners. And they were all janky and thrown together. And honestly, as much as 2016, 17, and 18 brought it into the kind of normal mind space, I still see a lot of that as extremely immature infrastructure and the tools and stuff that we had available. It wasn't until 2018 that Cash App even got involved, that it was even available, and it was a limited access for some pretty long span of time, if I remember correctly. And 2018 was also when Lightning launched. They were doing it on testnet, and then a whole bunch of people started, myself included, started running the hashtag reckless, super, alpha version of it or whatever on mainnet, and there was this explosion of channels, and nobody knew what the hell what was happening or what was going on, and then 80% of the network just kind of went stagnant or dead because people didn't know what to do with their channels and they were putting it on, they just threw it up on a device that they hadn't even intended to use at length, or it was a node that they just set up and then it goes offline and they don't check it. It was a mess. And that was a year after the whole block size war stuff. And I think it's easy to forget that Bitcoin itself, the thing, the protocol, the network, the software behind it, yes, we have a much broader ecosystem, we have more tools, we have more quote-unquote respectable people here, in the sense that the establishment now just kind of accepts that this is part of the economy. But at the end of the day, the foundation of this thing is still just a piece of node software. And I would absolutely say that the culture has become very complacent about what that entails when it comes to risk, and about our obligation to keep it running. The idea, and this is what I think, Shinobi goes into kind of a section on the whole, just dollar cost average, hold your own keys, whatever it is. What was his little list here? Just follow these simple steps to get economic salvation. Yeah, dollar cost average. Just read this book. Just follow these simple steps. Just get 0.1 Bitcoin, you'll have a seat at the table as a new economic elite of the New World Order. All of this stuff. And I think what he's getting at, which kind of showed up two paragraphs down, was the idea that there's nothing, that Bitcoin has already succeeded, that all we need to do is stack and not do anything. We don't really have to use it for anything. It is just, and I will quote Shinobi here, a quote, blind attitude of preordained success. And on this, I have to agree, because overconfidence is not a winning strategy. And Bitcoin is far from done with the challenges that it is going to have. If we are becoming complacent in any of the things, in any of the areas where Bitcoin is not shining. In fact, one of the things, everybody's talking about like big blocks again. And it's funny, like I'm not even in the mode of the idea of entertaining going like making blocks bigger again is so absurd to me, because we're in a position where right now the way Bitcoin is designed and the way the stamps and the inscription stuff is going is we're going to have an insanely bloated UTXO set. We've doubled the UTXO set since last year with UTXOs that are just toxic, and they're purposefully toxic. In fact, I think it was like Mike in Space or something in a video clip from a podcast that I saw very recently. I mean, I don't know if the podcast itself was recent. In fact, I suspect it wouldn't be, just because stamps have, they started doing this a while ago. So it's probably just something that got shared around again that was from back then. And maybe it was recent, but just talking about how their whole goal was to come up with a dirtier, a more toxic way to do this. Something that was going to be more computationally intensive, that was going to pointlessly use up more UTXOs, and was going to have the highest cost when it came to running a full node as any of the other mechanisms they had used up to that point. And that was the whole context in which he was like super proud and happy about this. Like literally shitting in the park and then taking a picture and be like, ha ha ha, somebody else has to clean this up. So I'm more worried about the node count, about the fact that we will probably reach the point in which a consumer device can easily sync and run an entire full node faster than had otherwise been projected. And without full nodes, none of this means anything. Like, none of this is secure, none of it is decentralized if you don't have a broad full node network. And also a diversity of clients, which I think a lot of people still forget about. Like, this ultimately is a cryptographic system. It is an engineered security consensus protocol. Like, God, this sounds like a bunch of just buzzwords, but I mean it seriously in the sense that this is about an architecture of security. If we do not understand why it is secure, and we start making compromises, or we start doing things to undermine that security without realizing it, or we watch it slowly degrade because we've just become complacent and we just think that Bitcoin is simply going to succeed, it will eventually get to a point where the benefit of attacking outweighs the cost and difficulty of committing that attack. And there's so many different attack vectors. There's so many different angles that this could be hit. It is an open global protocol. Anybody who can attack it can attack it. If it's easy to attack in some way, it doesn't even have to be a state actor. It could be a random anybody who comes up with some really clever way to cause a really, really big problem. That's why when I try to explain that the hardest money that is most trusted is going to succeed, when I reference that in the context of Bitcoin's inevitable success, I say, and I'm very deliberate about it, and I have been for many, many years, that all Bitcoin has to do is not die, and it will succeed because all the rest will be directed by the incentives. But this is not at all to say there's no work to do. That doesn't mean we don't have to use it. Quite the opposite. I'm saying that if it continues to succeed or if it continues to survive, we will all be using it. That everybody listening to this will be using it like I do today. And I think that future is 100% possible. But understand one thing that I really try to keep in mind and I try to constantly remind myself the framing of when I find myself diverting a little bit or stepping out of it or falling into the dogma and the kind of like the cultural platitudes that are so easy to swallow up a culture or a community or a group. I try to remember that what I actually am, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist. I am a Bitcoin maximalist in the sense that Bitcoin is the best and highest likelihood thing to achieve what I value. But ultimately, I am a digital sound money maximalist. If for some reason it ever seemed that Bitcoin was not going to be able to solve that, or that it was irreversibly destroyed or damaged and was unable to fulfill that purpose, I would be very sad. I would pour one out and I would drink one to the end of Bitcoin, but I would not let go of what I was looking for. I would simply find the thing that solved the problem that ultimately killed Bitcoin. I would not be dogmatically devoted to Bitcoin if it stopped doing what it is that I think is the most important thing to achieve in the world. And I think it's really easy to forget that Bitcoin is ultimately a cypherpunk project. It's a piece of software. It's a network. And it is oftentimes still a huge mess. And with or without consensus changes or upgraded features on the base layer, there's an enormous amount of work to do. There's just maintenance work to make sure that the software we have doesn't become vulnerable as technology and the environment changes. Inscriptions and stamps are actually kind of a good example of exactly what I mean. We just don't know how people are going to use this thing. We can set up as many filters, we can make it restrict as much as we possibly can for what we are allowed to put into the chain, and we will still find out that there are ways and things to do with that data that were not intended and have certain consequences. But Bitcoin only works because of the fact that it is a software with strict, insane levels of filtering as to what exactly can happen on chain. Like all of it, the whole thing, that's all the software is. It's just a giant tool for filtering all data that doesn't follow an extremely specific and detailed set of rules. And we need to realize, the laser-eyed Mac, whoever the hell it is, needs to realize that there is still a ton of work to be done. There are still a multitude of Bitcoin's shortcomings that we ought to address. That doesn't mean we need a soft fork, but it does mean we have a lot of work to do. It does mean that Bitcoin hasn't already won. Instead, Bitcoin has reached the point where the only way Bitcoin doesn't win is if we let it die. But that does not at all suggest that if we do nothing, it won't die. It is a brilliant, elegant, clunky, messy system in so many different ways. But it is not infallible. And the people who have let themselves become complacent by thinking that it is need to wake up a little bit. They need to sober up. I don't think it's doing us any favors. Now, just for anybody who is curious about my argument, the long form of my inscriptions and stamps and ordinals discussion, because I don't intend to talk about it anymore in this episode, which God knows with tangents, we don't really know if we're leaving this topic. But if you're curious about my stance on it, it really hasn't changed since the pooping in the park guys take. That is still largely my assessment of it. However, I will say that I think it's a slightly bigger problem because of stamps and because of this, and because there is a push in the subculture of the JPEG people to, I think, push for soft forks that are specifically around this, around doing more of this. But honestly, that's another conversation for another day. But relatively speaking, like, you can get the bulk of my thoughts on the entire issue from Guys Take 66, Pooping in the Park. That was from May of last year, by the way. I'll have the link in the show notes. But I think Shinobi makes a really astute observation when he says that most of what is, and not all of it, it's just kind of true of anything, that not all of it is like this, but that the most of what is happening over with the JPEG people is defined entirely in opposition to the quote-unquote laser-eyed maxis, to the Bitcoin purists, but that basically without them, there's nothing there. And I think the clip in question that I was just referring to a little bit ago, I think is a perfect example of that the framing of that mindset. Like, it seems pretty obviously true that the loudest voices and the most popular people in that entire section, that entire community, all seem to be popular specifically to the degree that they are able to quote-unquote pwn or piss off the laser-eyed maxis. Going back to the clip I was talking about, which I, by the way, I actually paused and tried to look for it. I couldn't find it, and I don't want to spend too much time on social media, so I didn't go over there hunting for it again. I'm currently on a hiatus from social media, which, just as a note, and I'll remember to mention this in the intro again as well, if you want to get up with me, find me on Keet and or Telegram. Probably those will be the best ways to get a hold of me until maybe after the halving or something. But I think that clip specifically was such a good indication, a good way to show what Shinobi actually suggests in this, is that the entire perspective is solely in opposition to the laser eyes, in the sense that the whole position, the whole mental frame for being able to brag about something that was more costly, was going to be a bigger drag on nodes, was going to have higher RAM and computational costs for managing a full node, and that they had figured out a more toxic way to do this, was purely because that meant it was going to piss off more laser eyes. That was the whole context in which it was worth caring about at all. And honestly, I think a lot of that culture, the opposition culture and how deeply they've dug in their heels, have made a lot of the laser eyes ridiculous. Like, it's hard to, the platitudes have fallen quite a bit, and the nuance, it kind of feels like what's happening on X, and maybe to some degree X was always like Twitter was always like this, but that's not true. There was a day where there was a really good discussion happening on Twitter. I think it just inevitably scales to the point where the discussion breaks down into absurdities and large groupthink sort of platitudes being thrown at each other, and all the nuance falls out of it because there's just too many people in the conversation. And in fact, that's another thing that Shinobi and I don't even really agree. We agree on some part of the whole inscription stamp sort of issue, but I think he's way more agnostic to it than I am. And he's argued that the idea of filtering or trying to mitigate this in any way will both be ineffective and also a slippery slope to censorship. And I disagree to varying specifics in both positions. But that's not what this episode is about, so I'm not going to get into all that again, and I'm sure it'll come back up on the show at some point. Maybe, I don't know, we'll have Shinobi on. I don't think I've had him... Have I ever had Shinobi on the show? I'm going to feel really stupid if I hadn't brought on Shinobi. That's definitely an episode we should do. But anyway, going back to the article and the point I was getting at, is I think he brings up I love his analogy to the church. I love his analogy to Catholicism, to Protestantism, and the Eastern Orthodox growing. And one of the pieces of this article that I thought was really interesting, and to think about how I immediately started going down the rabbit hole of my memory and everything that has happened in this space, and watching these quote-unquote schisms and the movement from one platform to another, because, you know, this shift that we've seen from Twitter to Noster and then is actually mirrors and has altered the level and degree of conversation, like how the conversation is actually unfolding, quite substantially, like in a really powerful way, very similar to how Twitter did the exact same thing to Reddit, and very similar to how Reddit did the exact same thing as things migrated from the Bitcoin Talk forums. And there's this strong element of the natural evolution of how groups and ideas clash, and how growing a group or growing a community to a certain size inevitably leads to internal dissent and separation. So I think there's a lot of really fascinating things and threads to kind of unpull in the fact that this is a natural progression of how this was going to happen. And I also find it really interesting in just kind of, there's actually a really great quote. I'll hit this just because this one struck me as soon as I started reading the article. I was just getting a little bit through it. And then this line caught me and I was like, okay, I'm going to read this one on the show. And I wanted to take a little bit of time to actually come back to it so I could pay better attention to it when I first found the article. But he lays out the kind of historical foundation of like understanding that the dogma and the way we think about Bitcoin and the decisions that unfolded from that and the block size wars and all of the clashing that occurred laid this kind of this foundation for everything that we have today. It's why things moved in the directions and evolved in the directions that they did, but that today that foundation is cracking. And then this is the quote that hit me and got me thinking a lot. And I went off and just kept thinking about it. And I thought it was just a fascinating lens to look through at a lot of other things in the world and how networks evolve. It says, "The thing with dogma is that the vast majority of the time it starts to fracture the growth of discontent and dissent within the existing dogma. It doesn't die, it multiplies. And that outgrowth externally tends to reinforce the existing dogma within those who remain." And the reason I think this shines a very interesting light on not only just everything that's going on with the whole inscriptions, ordinals, and the opposite of it, the two polar opposites of that whole thing, and how the kind of depth and dog-headedness of depth in the sense of like how deeply do we sink our heels in, and the dog-headedness of the kind of, oh my God, I don't know how you the normal Bitcoin dogma. I don't know how you distinguish exactly what it is that, I guess we'll just call it laser-eyed maxis. But I think there is a lot of reflection going on. There's a lot of antagonism for the sake of antagonism, for either being rejected or just building up your identity as this reflection of the worst absurdities that you see in some other group. Like, Udi is an interesting example, because Udi was a troll even when he was, quote-unquote, a Bitcoin maxi, right? He lived in opposition, and tons of people in the Bitcoin space did. Their entire thing was that, like, look at how awful shitcoins were. And there was a lot of bitterness. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of bitterness between that. Same in the whole big blocker, small blocker camp. The amount of just vicious antagonism. But Udi was very much kind of like the guy who could pick on the shitcoiners better, in a sense, or funnier than everybody else could. And then as soon as he was like outside of the group in any way, as soon as his perspective started to change, and then he wasn't just kind of like saying everything that the laser-eyed maxis wanted to hear, suddenly he was attacked. It's, you know, you get in the feedback loop of not agreeing, and then nuance can't happen, and then you're a troll anyway, so you just start enjoying the fact that you're pissing everybody off, and then you dig your heels down in the opposite direction, and now he became like the perfect opposite of what he was, right? He used to be the anti-shitcoin guy who was trolly and funny, and now his whole identity is the reverse. Now he's just the anti-laser eyes. And I think there's something in the social foundation of ideas that lead toward, when you have an explicitly opposing idea, that it actually hardens and redefines the original idea, where it didn't have strong edges or where people didn't know exactly what it was in relation to something else. Because you think about it, as groups get bigger, as fresh blood, so to speak, as noobs start to join a group, join a community, or believe something that other people believe, or trust or understand something that other people trust or understand, inevitably, I mean, just the nature of things, not even inevitably, it's just the nature of new people learning new things, it is less well-defined. Just a simple example is that people who come in and learn about the block size war and learn about the lessons may kind of understand the arguments and understand the nature of the block size war and what happened during that period, but they did not live and go on that journey when it was happening. They didn't experience the block size war. Therefore, their ability to paint or sharpen certain edges that some very small experience or some argument at some very specific place when you're in it trying to figure it out, you're going on this journey yourself and trying to understand the nuance and watching these people argue and having one little thing kind of tip the scales towards one perspective or one argument over another, because you've had like 100 touch points and one finally just kind of started putting those puzzle pieces together. Like, you're able to, going on that journey allows you to better define the edges and the concrete shape of an idea. It's like the difference between discovering something in the real world, like figuring out, like, you know, some physics equation or some relationship between gravity and objects and all of this thing, and then learning about it later in a textbook. Like, the person who learns it in a textbook may generally understand the philosophy or the principle, but they're probably not going to paint the same picture and the clarity of image in their mind as the person who discovered it, as the people who test it out for themselves and see what those equations or what that law of thermodynamics or whatever, what does it mean when you put it to application in the real world? And in that same way, dogma is like a shortcut to a lot of this stuff. It's the kind of the textbook shallow version of it. And a lot of people will pour into a group or community and try to understand, and they'll start getting little pieces of it and they'll understand it just a little bit, but very, very rarely with any significant amounts of nuance, if any at all. But funny enough, it's easier to begin to see what an idea might be or paint a picture of an idea if you have something that you believe is the opposite of that idea. It's like being able to look into a mirror and then, you know, start to define and see and think in your mind who you are because you have a mirror. Except that if that opposing belief isn't actually the opposite, it's just opposing from a social perspective rather than a logical perspective, what it likely simply does is trap you very tightly in dogma that is the opposite of this other person, the JPEG person or whatever it is, without it being real, but simply feeling that it's real because it has an antagonist. It seems to have cleaner edges as a concept or as a belief that people are holding simply because there's something trying to attack it or there's something bouncing off of it. So I find that really interesting that the external outgrowth and the multitude of new conflicting ideas start to actually both evolve but shine a little bit of a light, like become parts of the original idea, in the sense that those reflections either help define that idea more cleanly or poorly, actually do the opposite, is set themselves in position and actually obscure some of the original idea, because there are so many people who will now think of themselves or position their framework as the opposing of this other side, which is why, you know, blue and red, by left and right politics, is such an absolute disaster of no nuance, of no genuine trying to understand what the other person's position is, and a constant embodiment or embracing of just what the other doesn't like. It becomes so dogmatic and so socially competitive and divisive that sometimes things are literally embraced just because they know it will piss off those other people. But then there's the first half of that quote, which I think is also really fascinating and really interesting to think about in the natural evolution of Bitcoin's progress and becoming a global phenomenon. That when the dogma starts to fracture, it doesn't die, it multiplies. And I think it's really interesting, aside from the whole, like, just creating an ideology or a dogma to oppose some other dogma just to be their reflection, aside from that specifically, just in the idea of the dogma and the kind of belief system fractures and multiplies into, you know, 100 different pieces, I think is really interesting to think about in the context of the scaling of social consensus. In the sense that, you know, all of the dogma, all of the platitudes, all of the beliefs around Bitcoin are a social consensus. They are not protocol consensus. They're a social problem. And as Bitcoin grows, the dogma and belief system will have to split off because it's impossible to get an entire group to agree, even if you get them to agree on some fundamental value or some fundamental thing that I think Bitcoin embodies from the very concept of Bitcoin or whatever it is that you're around. A great example being the analogy to the Catholic Church is the idea of Jesus and God and all of these things, these foundations of the religion, of the belief system remain. But that because so many various minds, value systems, histories, experiences need to be encompassed, that inevitably it starts to bifurcate. It in the social sphere, it breaks apart and creates this multitude of various ideologies and belief systems that either do fit into the entire umbrella of the overarching belief system or are actually their own little twisted way to try to hold some contradictory beliefs. They kind of have like some special thing. Like I genuinely kind of consider the people who believe in universal basic income and Bitcoin at the same time part of this category of this, like what is actually believed in when it comes to Bitcoin is the belief in full-on sovereignty, property rights, and that fair money is in fact the best way for society to organize, while universal basic income runs logically counter to all of that. Not to mention, isn't even possible without a specific violation of Bitcoin's rules and the values that it instantiates. But interestingly, that this type of schism, this type of divisiveness and internal dissent, may actually just be a sign of its success as a belief system. That this is a natural consequence to the scaling of Bitcoin across too many different groups with too many different backgrounds and experiences and cultures, such that the dogma and the framing of the belief system that Bitcoin stands for has to actually diverge. And I think that's just a really interesting framing, an interesting lens to look at Bitcoin through, especially where we are in Bitcoin's history. When you look out, like we just, ETFs just started, right? Like this just opened up into the establishment world and we are about to have a flood of new people, which means I think we should expect a lot of these continued schisms and internal dissent and the separation and division of these groups. And it's also likely going to mean that any soft forks are just going to, which I think was always going to be natural, soft forks are going to be that much more difficult to actually implement, even though they are backwards compatible, even though, you know, it doesn't require everyone's participation in totality or everyone's total agreement, but also that the idea of a hard fork succeeding, I think, is just increasingly just painfully unrealistic. But I thought the framing and the analogy of the church was a really good one to kind of pair with understanding, you know, what we're looking at from kind of a higher level social perspective, and also how prevalent it was. You know, this was actually kind of a slogan in the idea of why the fork was always going to be a terrible path, because, you know, we still frame this stupid thing this argument from 2017 in the block size wars as if it was small blockers versus big blockers. But it's funny, small blockers versus big blockers is literally a perfect example of what I was just mentioning earlier, is that the opposing argument tends to redefine and reshape the original argument or the original position or dogma, because ultimately the conversation wasn't about big blockers versus small blockers. It was about hard fork versus soft fork. It was about the fundamental change and the risk to the network of breaking the consensus rules and trying to come up with some conversation or some other course of action that wasn't within the protocol consensus, that relied entirely on social consensus, which we were clearly not going to get, and how messy and how dangerous that process was, which I think was a perfect example and perfectly proven by all of the things that occurred during the block size war. And to this day, we still misapply and call it this small blockers versus big blockers, when that was really not the framing. That was the framing that the big blockers thought it was, and that the small blockers, the quote-unquote, the soft forkers, the entire framing and argument was actually redefined by the fact that the big blockers said, by what the big blockers said they were against. And I remember being annoyed even then of constantly being called a small blocker, when the notion that that was the important part of the conversation as to whether or not we wanted big blocks or small blocks was such a complete distraction from what I thought the most important issue was. And the most important issue, SegWit, was bigger blocks. It was bigger blocks. The question was, are we going to rely on social consensus and we are going to fundamentally and irreversibly fork this network, fork the protocol consensus, and start believing that we can just socially bitch and scream at each other and then fundamentally change the rules of the network, in which any rule could be changed, and that any new bug, the degree of bug that is possible when we start talking about hard forking and moving everyone to a singular client and giving up, just basically sunsetting every other client, every other wallet, every other balance that anybody had. Somebody been holding Bitcoin for 5 years, they were not going to be able to boot up their software, see it, and access it at all if we hard forked. And that was such a crucial part of the discussion. It was one of the most, it was the most important issue in my mind. Is it, were we fundamentally breaking consensus, or were we finding a solution within consensus? Especially on an insanely divisive issue. And one of the things that we had said, and that was a very common, tagline, whatever you want to call it, of the arguments and things thrown around from that era, was live by the fork, die by the fork. And there's another quote from this article. It says, "We have seen the same thing with big blockers. First, the Bitcoin Cash people split from Bitcoin. Then Bitcoin Cash split into Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV. Both of them had numerous splits from that point among themselves. Why should anyone expect the JPEG people to be any different?" I really think it's interesting that that happened, and that this was a dynamic that was even discussed openly during that period, was that if we accept social consensus as the thing that can just fundamentally change Bitcoin, you're setting a precedent. It becomes a defining part of the culture. And now everyone and anyone is just going to want to fork and believe that they can just dominate the space, the community, the ecosystem, socially, and the consensus rules of Bitcoin don't fundamentally matter because they are not what holds us together. It's just social consensus, and we're going to fork, and we're just going to do whatever we want, which is just kind of the undermining, or the rejection of the very thing that makes Bitcoin such an insanely powerful and revolutionary technology, is a protocol consensus on the set of rules. One that is secure in the absence of social consensus. As I've said for many years, Bitcoin is strong when we are disagreeing. Argument and the ability to find social consensus or to make alterations is a potent form of security when it comes to the social and cultural sphere. But not only was the indication or the concept that, you know, social consensus was just going to be, it was going to be a stupid way to run this thing, and that it was never going to work, and, you know, live by the fork, die by the fork, is how unbelievably quickly Bitcoin Cash then had their own internal schism, new divisiveness, and then Bitcoin SV broke off. And then each of them continued. I remember for years, I just like would casually watch, you know, and keep up to date. And they would just, they'd just like, oh, we're going to do this client. And then they forked again. It was pretty regular to see them all infighting and ending in a fork, whereas Bitcoin infighting continued to essentially result in no progress and falling back onto the protocol consensus. But this was just a really good article. A lot of really fun ideas to kind of unpack in this. And I think it's very interesting how much there is to learn in kind of applying the religious dogma and just kind of the idea of ideology as a system, as a network system, and thinking about how Bitcoin is inevitably going to scale, how Bitcoin, how it will look as Bitcoin scales, and what will happen to communities and cultures and dogmas within the Bitcoin space as time passes. And, you know, what does it look like for Bitcoin to be 2 billion people? And maybe it is a Catholic church and then this giant splintering and subsystem of Protestant and all of these other things, where fundamentally the belief in, you know, money without the state is kind of the core underlying system and the protocol, the 21 million, the fundamental rules of Bitcoin that define Bitcoin, become just the underlying foundation, the base on which an entire, a plethora of various ideologies and kind of dogmas around or extending or even kind of contradicting and semi-opposing this thing is born, and new communities expand to try to accommodate the various backgrounds, the various ways of thinking and mental framing of all of the people who will eventually be in Bitcoin. And this will probably be a time in which we will see a lot of it. So that framing will probably help to get an interesting, paint an interesting picture of everything that's happening as it unfolds in the next couple of years. So with that, a huge thank you to Shinobi for this article, as always. Bitcoin Magazine, link will be in the show notes if you want to check that out or read any of his other articles. Don't forget to get a cold card and buy your Bitcoin on Swan. A huge thank you to them for supporting the show. And I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys.
Kill you? What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, you complete me.